From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
I'm Patrick Donges, filling in this week for David Gastina. Coming up, questions are being raised as to whether Governor Cuomo is living up to his pledge to run the most transparent administration in history after reporters discovered top Cuomo aides removed documents from the state archives related to his time as attorney general. We'll hear more on that from Dave Lucas and get analysis from our political observer, Dr. Alan Shartok. We'll also hear more about the state Senate's last-minute allocation of education bullet aid and take a look at monitoring the state's waterways that may end up being near hydrofracked wells. Those stories and more are coming up on the Legislative Gazette. What should have been a routine process to review papers in the New York State Archives relating to Governor Cuomo's term as Attorney General took an unexpected path for two newspaper reporters. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
Jimmy Veelkind says he and colleague Jim Odato set out to simply review whatever records existed that were created by Andrew Cuomo when he was the state Attorney General. Those records, by law, go to the state archives. The two Albany Times Union reporters wanted to take a look at the contents in 30 boxes of files stored at the archives, which is a branch of the state education department, to get a broader picture of Cuomo's time as AG. They filed legal requests under the Freedom of Information Law. Veelkind had gotten some information from the archives, but when he went back to check it, it had disappeared. He concluded from his experience that members of the governor's staff may go over material before reporters arrive at the archives, review it after they leave, and then remove what they don't think should be seen.
We were surprised to find out that the archives had one of Cuomo's top aides do the actual review under the Freedom of Information Law. Now, the law prescribes that documents can be held back from the public for a number of reasons. Personal privacy, they don't want to release documents that could compromise an ongoing investigation, and documents that represent attorneys' work product are also privileged under FOIL. But exactly who characterizes this was something that is important, because these exemptions are open to interpretation, and we and the former state archivist were surprised to find out that the person who did interpret these exemptions was someone who continues to be a close aide to the governor.
Veelkind believes that Governor Cuomo is carefully managing his image and that that management is now apparently extending to the state archives. He notes that good government advocates have called for tougher laws on the books when it comes to archiving public records.
There has been a bill that has passed both houses of the state legislature and has been vetoed by governors, including Governor David Patterson, that would have mandated governors send their papers to the archives. So good government advocates have pushed for enactment of laws like this, and I think we might see more of a renewed push in light of our story.
One Cuomo official reportedly questioned the Times Union's fixation on the governor's records management. Veelkind believes what he and Odato encountered should serve as a lesson for all.
This is how the governor and his aides have acted. I think that it's telling about their approach to government, and it's telling about how, again, meticulously they manage the governor's image and how tight they try to control the flow of information about the governor and about state government. I think that's important for the general public to realize here.
The Times Union also discovered Cuomo's schedule records as AG couldn't be foiled because they'd been tossed out. Governor Cuomo's office did not return calls asking for comment on transparency and on the newspaper articles. Robert Freeman, executive director of the New York State Committee on Open Government, says the Cuomo administration's approach was permissible under New York laws.
The governor was not attorney general a terribly long time ago. He was attorney general within the past couple of years. And certainly there are cases, there are issues that were alive when he was attorney general, which may be alive today. Certainly there are names that appear in the records which could justifiably be withheld, witnesses, informants. There are any number of possibilities. Now, and this is something that comes up frequently. When a request is made to a government agency, it goes to the so-called records access officer. That is the person who has the duty of coordinating the agency's response to requests for records. Well, what if the access officer really doesn't know a heck of a lot about the records? What if the access officer is not really familiar with the impact of disclosure? What does that person do? That person gets in touch with somebody who is familiar with the content and the effect of disclosure. And I think that that's what the archives did.
Freeman appeared Tuesday on WAMC's Vox Pop. The New York Times points out that the so-called editing of the archived material comes at a time when the governor is being much discussed as a 2016 presidential candidate. The Cuomo administration's position is that the Times Union was working on a manufactured story and was trying to create controversy. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
Joining us now, the Legislative Gazette's political observer, Dr. Alan Shartok. Alan, Filegate, as it's been called, the files gone missing from the archives on Governor Cuomo's time as AG. What do you make of it?
Well, first of all, I think the governor's office misplayed it. Now, Patrick, I've always been one who believes that political happenstance, things that happen, almost always go to the character of the person at the top. In this case, I think, you know, this effort to control what is in the archives, because that's what the story is all about. After Andrew Cuomo was attorney general, they sent some stuff down to the archives. They didn't send a lot, but they sent some stuff. The Times Union of Albany, New York, doing its good work, sent two of their ace reporters down there, and they started looking for stuff, and they found something that had to do with the so-called Trooper Gate. Out comes this memo that they found. They have a copy of it, and yet somebody must have squealed because the governor's guys go down to these very archives and grab a lot of the stuff that's there and saying it's client representing a conflict of interest in terms of their client. The client, of course, is the state of New York, but also the voters who put the governor and the previous, and when he was AG, there. Well, I know this all sounds pretty complicated, but it goes to the idea that if you try to control information too much, you make a story out of something that never would have been a story otherwise. This is something that goes to Andrew Cuomo. We know it. We know he calls people. We know he yells at people. We know that his people call people and yell at them. We know that they take on the New York Times, that they take on the Times Union. Let me tell you something. In the end, that's a fight you can't win. And I've seen it done when the papers were dead wrong. In this case, the papers were not wrong. Cuomo is having people beat them up, and it really turns out to be very bad for him. He made a mountain out of a molehill.
Now, you spoke earlier this week on air with the Committee on Open Government Executive Director Bob Freeman, and he seemed to say that, in part, you know, everybody makes mistakes. What's your take on that?
Well, remember that Andrew Cuomo is the guy who hires the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State is the one who hires the wonderful Bob Freeman. He is a hero in Albany. He's a hero because he says to agencies of government, you must give them newspapers this information. But in this case, and I have nothing but respect for him, he was somewhat defensive of Cuomo and Cuomo's reasons to do this. So my take on it is, if I were sitting in any seat of any agency that reported to Andrew Cuomo, I wouldn't want to tick him off. It's that simple. The guy is very strong. He's very forceful. He's a master controller of minutia and everything else that goes on underneath him. And somebody panicked and had them seize that memo and go and get it, even though they knew the newspaper had it. And all it did was to call attention and also signals a fight with probably the preeminent news organization in the United States, the New York Times, who did a big feature on this. It didn't help him. It was a dumb move on the Cuomo administration's part.
Our political observer, Dr. Alan Chartok. Alan, thank you.
You're welcome.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York state government and politics. I'm Patrick Donges, filling in this week for David Gustina. The spiny water flea, an invasive aquatic plankton, was confirmed in the Champlain Canal system this month. Scientists in the region are asking New York state officials to close gates in the canal system to prevent its spread into Lake Champlain and other water bodies. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley reports.
Within the last few weeks, researchers confirmed the presence of the new invasive in the Feeder Canal and the Champlain Canal above Lock 11. To prevent the spiny water flea spread into Lake Champlain, Lake George, lake systems in the Adirondacks, and in Vermont, more than 60 scientists, researchers, and groups have signed on to a letter asking the New York State Canal Corporation to immediately close the Glens Falls Feeder Canal. They note that the gates are closed every fall, and shutting them down now would prevent the invasive from spreading. Green Mountain College Professor of Biology Mariel Brooks is co-director of the Lake Champlain Research Consortium.
Once the spiny water flea gets into Lake Champlain, it's really too late to do anything about it. I mean, you can spend a lot of money studying the damage, but there's very little that you can do to get rid of it. I mean, nothing, in fact. So prevention, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, I would say, in this case. And we are all aware that it would cause some hardship to some people, but not nearly as much as would probably occur once the water flea gets there.
The plankton has had severe impacts in other water bodies by disrupting the natural food chain. Lake Champlain Committee staff scientist Mike Winslow says once this organism enters Lake Champlain, there will be no stopping it.
Our only option is to prevent it from getting here. So temporary inconveniences associated with closing the canal can be redeemed later, whereas if we miss this opportunity, we have no way to go back.
Mike Winslow adds that the tiny invasive has a large potential to damage the lake's ecosystem.
It's a huge risk. We have no invasive plankton in the lake at this time. So it's an invasive species that's going into a place in the food web where right now it's just as it was when the glaciers left. So it's hard to predict what will happen. We anticipate that there'll be effects on the fish community. We can be certain that there'll be effects on the other plankton that the fish are currently eating. There's some evidence from the Great Lakes that certain fish species don't do well because the larval stages can't feed on the spiny water fleas like they do the native plankton. But it's a big risk, and it's one that we can't undo if it happens.
Email exchanges earlier this week between Tim Myhook, who confirmed the presence of the spiny water flea in the Champlain Canal, and other scientists in the region indicated that the Canal Corporation would not close the feeder canal because of navigation concerns. But the rapid response team is assessing possible courses of action. Myhook, who was unavailable for comment, is co-director of the Lake Champlain Research Consortium with Mariel Brooks, who is frustrated by the lack of immediate action.
We obviously understand that there are costs and benefits to controlling these things, but it's frankly quite frustrating to sit by and see, well, we know this is coming, and not be able to do anything about it because the cost-benefit analysis doesn't ever bring to bear the economic cost of the invasive getting in until after the fact. Future damage is hard to argue. It's just not evident and salient in people's minds.
Calls to the New York State Canal Corporation were not returned in time for this broadcast.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
It's called bullet aid, but others have called it school district pork. Extra state aid to school districts and libraries doled out by the majority parties that control the New York State Senate and State Assembly. The latest bullet aid from the State Senate Republicans is going, by and large, to schools and libraries in the districts now held by Republican senators. The Legislative Gazette's Brian Shields spoke with Nikki Jones of the Alliance for Quality Education, a school and education advocacy group.
Years we've lost, school districts have lost $2.7 billion because of cuts coming out of Albany. And this current year, there was an $850 million restoration that simply doesn't make up for the hole. There's no way that that so-called bullet aid is going to fill the holes left by the lack of state aid. I'm certain that it's a welcome amount of financing for school districts, but what we need are policies to be changed out of Albany that are regressive.
Is this aid being distributed on a fair basis, even though it's coming after the fact?
Certainly, there's been some issues and discrepancies around the aid being distributed fairly. I mean, obviously, Alliance for Quality Education advocates for fairness and money being distributed based on need and not by geographic location or political will. We have children across the state who have lost a number of teachers and programs that they need to be ready for college and career, such as after school, pre-K, kindergarten, sports, and tutoring. And these are the programs that are being lost. These are the positions that are being lost in our schools. It is an education crisis, and certainly, again, bullet aid is not going to fill the lack of fairness in our state aid.
What will happen when the school year begins in September because of the cuts in the state budget that was passed in March and April?
Again, we're in the midst of an education crisis, and we're being pushed further and further in towards educational insolvency, where districts just cannot afford, because the state has passed the buck, districts cannot afford to make sure that our students are having a high-quality education. When you take teachers and social workers and guidance counselors and you take pre-K and early childhood programs away from students, you're not setting them up with a firm foundation so that they can be ready for college and careers. We've already seen right now some children are in summer school classes that the programs have been weakened, so there are fewer classes available in their neighborhoods and their communities.
The governor has said repeatedly he doesn't understand why some of these districts cannot live within their means, why they have to raise their tax rates every year well above the rate of inflation. What's your reaction?
Well, again, when Albany passes the buck, Albany has a constitutional obligation to make sure that every student is offered a sound basic education. When you make huge cuts from Albany and when you put policies in place such as the property tax cap, which make it virtually impossible for locals to raise the money, and when you put a state spending cap in place, which says no matter what's going on, no matter how many teachers and programs have been cut, we're only going to spend this amount of money, we are setting our children up for failure. There's no other way around that. School districts, obviously, they need money to operate. You need money to pay for teachers and programs and such. There's no other way around saying that.
That's Nikki Jones, Communications Director at New York State Education Advocacy Group, the Alliance for Quality Education, speaking with the Legislative Gazette's Brian Shields. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics, I'm Patrick Donjes, filling in for David Gustina. New York has more than 70,000 miles of rivers and streams running through it. As the possibility of hydrofracking in the state draws nearer, many see a threat to those waterways. Local groups have already started monitoring streams and likely drilling areas, the Innovation Trail's Matt Richmond reports.
On a humid Wednesday in July, Kathy Cronin crouches in Pierce Creek in the city of Binghamton. The creek empties into the Susquehanna River, just upstream from the city water treatment plant. Houses line the creek banks, and the sounds of the freeway can drown out the creek's churn. Cronin, who lives in Binghamton, dips a small electronic meter into the water. Scott Laufer, another local resident, is standing just downstream, waiting for the results.
All right, we got a conductivity reading of 435 and a total Dizelle cell reading of 210. And we'll record that on our data sheet.
They're measuring those two indicators, conductivity and total dissolved solids, because if they rise dramatically, that means the stream's probably contaminated with fracking wastewater. Right now, high-volume hydraulic fracturing still hasn't come to this watershed. Laufer and Cronin are collecting baseline data as part of the Sierra Club's Water Sentinels program. Their goal is to collect a year's worth of readings before any wells are drilled nearby.
We want to be able to say to them, this stream always looked like this before you came, and now it looks like this. There's no precedent for that.
If their monitoring shows raised levels from drilling, they'll send samples for detailed testing to a lab. One place that does testing is the Community Science Institute. It's an Ithaca nonprofit that has started water monitoring efforts in advance of fracking in the Southern Tier. The Institute is training volunteers in the five counties that are likely to see drilling first. Becky Bowen is the Institute's outreach coordinator. She says volunteers are looking for the more subtle signs of pollution from drilling.
Catastrophes are not really hard to spot. You know, we know when there's been an explosion or a big spill. You know, we don't need volunteers to monitor for that. You know, we know when that happens.
At the Sierra Club, Jessica Helm says the monitoring that volunteers can do is impossible for the Department of Environmental Conservation to keep up with.
The DEC, if it were working at perfect capacity, it still wouldn't be able to cover all of the watersheds we have in New York State.
And the DEC appears to be working at far from perfect capacity. The agency's staff has lost a fifth of its workers since 2008. Also, according to a report by the environmental group Earthworks, the agency's travel budgets have been cut, and three-quarters of the state's existing wells go uninspected each year. For volunteers like Kathy Cronin, that history is not a good omen for how the DEC might handle hydrofracking.
And I'm not sure what they need to do. I just know that they need to do more.
So volunteers like Cronin and Laufer will continue visiting their streams every month, if and when fracking comes to New York. In Binghamton, I'm Matt Richman for InnovationTrail.org.
Support for the Innovation Trail comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Innovation Trail is a collaboration between five upstate public media outlets reporting about New York's innovation economy. You can hear more at InnovationTrail.org. That does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies of this program are available by calling 1-800-323-9262. That number again is 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1230, or just listen or podcast us on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Patrick Donges. David Gustina will return next week.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.